There's a lot of research that says that a negative interaction can have up to 5 times the impact of a positive interaction. If you can remove even just a handful of microstress interactions in your daily life, that's going to have a really material impact on the quality of your everyday life in a way that doesn't require you to just be stronger and stronger for dealing with more stress.
Today on In Session, Leading the Judiciary, Karen Dillon, co-author with Rob Cross of The Microstress Effect, How Little Things Pile Up and Create Big Problems, and What to Do About It, describes their discovery of the cumulative, unrecognized small stresses causing significant impact on even the highest performing employees. Called microstresses, they can add up to inexplicable exhaustion at the end of even the most uneventful workday. Removing even a few microstresses and building strong social networks outside of work can help leaders foster greater resilience, improve performance, and combat burnout in themselves and those they lead. Karen Dillon is a contributing editor at Harvard Business Review, editorial director at Banyan Global Family Business Advisors, and co-author of 3 books with Clayton Christensen, including the New York Times bestseller, How Will You Measure Your Life? Special thanks to today's host, Lori Murphy, Assistant Division Director for Executive Education at the Federal Judicial Center. Lori, take it away.
Karen, we're so happy to have you. Thanks for being here.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Karen, your book is all about what you call microstress, which is not a term I had heard before. So help us understand what microstress is, how it's different from regular stress, and why we need to understand the difference.
So it's not a term that existed before. It's a term that my co-author and I, Rob Cross, came up with to try to describe something we were seeing in our research that we didn't think there was good language for. So microstress, in our definition, is tiny moments of stress that happen in routine interactions throughout your day that are so brief and so routine that your brain barely registers them, but whose cumulative toll is really significant. So microstress is really largely unnoticed or largely invisible to most of us. And I'll give you a difference between microstress and macrostress to explain it a little bit. So a macrostress is something that's big and significant and it's visible and our body actually responds to it. So it might be a major health issue, a really toxic boss, and you're aware of it. We know how to talk about and have empathy for and support one another for that. And we even know in some ways how to cope with that ourselves. Microstress, by contrast, might be you don't have a toxic boss, but you have a boss who's really, you know, well-intended but keeps changing the priorities, it seems like, on a daily or weekly basis, and you're always trying to scramble to catch up to what he or she expects of you. Or it might not be you have a major health issue, but it might be that yet again, you have to cancel meeting your friends for the walk, and you're just starting to worry about your health slipping away and your friendship suffering as a result of you being the person who once again can't turn up. So there's a difference between the macro stress that we see and know and micro stress, which our body just sort of absorbs because it's life, but is actually taking a really significant toll on us overall.
How did you and Rob notice this thing that you coined as micro stress?
Well, we were doing research on a slightly different project. We were doing research into high performers. And initially, our goal was to understand what do they do better than the rest of us? How do high performers stay high performers? But in our interviews, we started to see something that we hadn't expected to find, that even these very high performers, who the world saw as high performers, were kind of hanging on by a thread, really, to get through a day, a week, a month. They were better than most of us at coping with that. But they also had more than the rest of us. So we thought if they're hanging on by a thread, these high performers who are good at navigating this, what about the rest of us who maybe aren't so naturally hardwired to be the top, top performers?
How does microstress impact us, these microstresses that build and are fairly routine?
So microstresses happen from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed, and then even sort of work on our brains after we go to bed. So a simple thing would be most of us could leave the house in the morning with having kind of curt words with our kids or our spouse or our partner over something inconsequential. But that's already a microstress. Our body's natural defense mechanisms against stress are not triggered by these small ones, but they build up. And so I think a good metaphor for it is you have a cup that you start filling up in the morning with drops, 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 drops. And you can carry that cup all day. But as you get to the end of the day, it's totally full. And one extra micro stress or one extra bad thing happening to you is going to make it overflow. It's why so many of us come home at the end of the day and we're fried and we're tired, but we can't really even remember why. Nothing special happened during the day, just a routine day. And then unfortunately, because our cup is so full by the time we come home with the micro stress, we tend to be more triggered by the micro stresses that come at home at the end of the day. You know, we're curt at the dinner table, or we don't connect with our spouse the way we want to. It means that you're not the person you want to be with your friends and your family at home. So that while individually each of these micro stresses sounds small and insignificant, cumulatively, they just add up to that overflowing cup, and the stress takes a really significant toll.
You say in the book that micro stress, in your definition, is interrelational.
Yes, from our research, micro stress comes in the interactions with other people. It comes because we argued with somebody about the fact that we didn't finish getting something done on time, or we have a slightly tense conversation with a colleague because we're realizing we're on a slightly different page on our priorities, or an ask of us from somebody requires us to then go in turn and ask other people favors or to put work aside. It's the interactions that trigger the micro stress.
Can you help us understand primary and secondary micro stresses?
Sure. So again, in our research, primary micro stresses, the things that directly happen to you, an interaction that causes you to have to respond to that in some way, can often trigger secondary and even tertiary responses as well. So a great secondary example is not uncommon in our research with somebody that just ended up having to stay late at work to finish whatever late ask or miscommunication or misalignment with a colleague, which then bleeds into their evening, which means that they didn't get to sit down with their teen at dinner the way they had wanted to. And so there was nothing about the initial microstress that in theory should have affected their relationship or their concern or their worry over their teen. You don't feel like the parent you want to be, or you end up finding that you're not being the sibling you want to be to your siblings because you're so busy with the first and the second order effects. So microstresses almost always have ripple effects. They ripple on in your brain and in your life for much longer than that.
That's a good way to put it, ripple effects. I was thinking a spillover effect. Yes. into other relationships. And it sounds like we're actually carrying those micro stresses well beyond the day we experience them.
We do. Our brains are processing it, but because it hasn't registered on our frontal lobe, literally the way that a more significant stress would, our bodies are feeling the toll of it, and we're kind of carrying the emotion of that without even knowing it. There's a lot of interesting research about the effects of small stresses and micro stress. And one thing I thought was really fascinating is there's research that suggests if we are exposed to social stress within 2 hours of eating a meal, that our body will metabolize that meal as if we ate, I think it's 110 more calories than we did. And if that's, you know, a couple extra bites, but if that happened to us every day, if what we ate was metabolized as if we ate more than we actually did, we would gain 11 pounds in a year. And that's just one example. Wow. Of the sort of very unseen effects that last, that linger from having micro stress throughout your day. And most people in busy work life jobs just are battered with micro stress. And so our body's doing its best to respond, but it is taking a physical and emotional toll.
What are the things that we're doing to ourselves that we could stop doing to decrease the number of micro stresses we experience?
So being conscious of the ones that are the routinely part of your day, and I'll just make a point on why it's such a worthwhile thing to try to push back on some micro stress. Again, individually, if you wrote down the micro stresses in your life, they may sound silly to an outsider, but again, cumulatively, they're taking a toll. And our classic response to stress in society has always been doing things to make us stronger for dealing with stress. I mean, and they're all good things, meditation, mindfulness, showing gratitude, things like that. Those are good and helpful ways to make you stronger. But there's a lot of research that says that a negative interaction can have up to 5 times the impact of a positive interaction. So it's a much higher leverage opportunity to remove some stress from your life rather than just continually try to find ways to be stronger to dealing with the stress. So if you can remove even just a handful of micro-stress interactions in your daily life, that's going to have a really material impact on the quality of your everyday life in a way that doesn't require you to just be stronger and stronger for dealing with more stress. So just being aware that these are significant things that take a toll. If you are in charge of managing or leading people, that's actually a really significant source of micro-stress. We sort of absorb some of what micro-stress that's just about wanting them to do well or stepping in to sort of over-coach and mentor all the time because you don't want them to screw up or bringing that home. You're worried, you know, you're having to have your third conversation with someone who reports to you about improving on X or Y thing. You bring that home with you emotionally. So we absorb the micro-stresses that we're surrounded by. So being aware of the interactions that are causing micro-stress for you and thinking is a different way to do it. In the book, we suggest a simple exercise to at least start to get on top of micro-stress in a way that you might be able to push back on, which is that we ask you to pick two or three micro-stresses that interactions that are happening systemically enough, routinely enough for you, that it would be worth seeing, can I fix or change or push back on that in some way? Can I stop having this meeting with this particular colleague that always ends up leaving me confused? Can we communicate in writing instead? Or figuring out if you could change two or three of those that are directly affecting you and you know affecting your sort of overall productivity and your sort of emotional well-being. And then we also say, because reality is reality, we can't make it all go away. Pick two or three that are kind of getting under your skin, but you just accept, you know what, I'm not going to be able to change it. It's not really going to matter in, 6 years later in my life. It might matter for 6 weeks or 6 months, but just kind of consciously choose to let go of that one. It may be a particular colleague whose confrontational style gets under your skin. It may be a particular task that you have to do, even though it's thankless and it's part of your job, but you just accept it. But decide to let go of a couple. One of the most significant things we found in our research for the people who were very good at coping with microstress, better than most, we started calling them the 10%ers because it was about 10% of our research pool, was that those people found ways to make sure their life had what we call multidimensional activities and connections. It just kind of mitigates the intensity of the microstress when you have other things and other people to talk to and activities that refresh your brain in some way. So I've made a real point of making that an active part of my life and not letting it be the thing that falls off, which it almost does for all of us as we get older. We sort of let that be the less important thing in our life because we're so busy. I've made time for that. And I think it has really rejuvenating effect pushing back on microstress.
Give us an example of someone you met who was a 10%er and how they mitigate some of these microstresses.
So I found them fascinating because they have the same number of hours in the day as the rest of us, but they just made sure that they worked in time. Sometimes it was a twofer, but for activities that made them feel more like a whole person. So example is there was a guy who organized a really informal soccer game on the weekends for parents and kids, you know, friends. And it was just a way for him to have other adult contact, but to feel physically fit and be with his family at the same time. There was a guy who he and his wife just put on Facebook, anyone want to join us for dinner on such and such a day? We're going to make a reservation. Just turn up. And they made it really simple. They didn't make it complicated. And it was a way that they could stay connected with their friends. Or even people who just did their annual getaway, their girls' weekend with their college friends. They just kind of made time. They didn't let months and years go by before they connected with other people. But I'll give you a really fun example. There was a guy who was a neurosurgeon at a very prestigious New York hospital whose, life and career had been consumed by his work for a long time. And after the initial phase of research with us, when we were talking to him about the importance of this multidimensional life, he literally joined a rock band, like a weekend rock band. He decided to get his guitar out of the closet. He hadn't played it for years. And he went into his local music store just looking for music to get himself back in the game. And he saw a flyer that was something like weekend band, what we lack in talent, we make up for in volume or something like that. And he ended up joining it and he was much older than the people in the band, but that was part of what was so refreshing for him. He didn't become best friends with them, but he had a weekend experience that put him in different space and connected with human beings in a different way and also made him feel good about dusting off his old talent. So people found different ways to do it, but they were all good at making sure that still stayed a priority for them, even just in small moments, that they found ways to be connected to human beings beyond work and family.
Excellent. So there's ways to mitigate micro stresses in the workplace and then also in our real lives as well.
The real lives I sort of think of as almost an inoculation. It creates something we started to call in our research a resilience network, meaning there were a variety of people in your life, in work and outside of work, who could help you get through difficult patches in different ways. It wasn't that you had to have more best friends, ride or die friends for that would really have your back in crises. That's good. But it's also good to have someone who can help you see a different perspective, or can sort of say, you know, feel sorry for yourself for a day or two, then get back in the game. Life goes on. Having a variety of types of relationships in your life can help you be resilient to the challenging things that we all go through.
What can leaders do besides attending to their own micro stress? How can they help their staff to deal with or to decrease the number of micro stresses that their staff experience?
We cause micro stress for other people without realizing and without meaning to. And that is not just about trying to be a better boss or a better manager. It just, the reality is it almost always boomerangs back on us. You know, you think about your star performer who you load, overload with responsibilities. Eventually that's going to backfire in some way. They're going to want to leave, or they're going to be petulant or be fried, or their work quality is going to suffer, and that's going to come back to you. So there's some sort of macro things and some micro things. On a macro level, I think most organizations have unnecessarily structural complexity. Things get built on top of and dotted lines and new committees, and you're on multiple teams and you cross collaborate in some ways, but we almost never sort of look at and challenge, does this make sense to have this many people working on this, or having the way this reporting structure works, or even our processes? We almost always add to things, but we never take things away, because organizations have become more matrixed, and because we need to work and collaborate with more people. The more people we collaborate with and the more matrixed organizations and flatter even hierarchies, that creates so many opportunities for microstress interactions during the day. So examining that at a high level, and as a leader, really thinking about the ways that you unintentionally cause microstress for your team. The priority shift is one of the biggest things we found in our research, is that well-intended leaders, without thinking so hard about it, this is our priority, and then maybe it's this is our priority, and then maybe we want both things to happen at the same time. You don't think about the consequences of not having clear, straightforward directions and for misalignments with busy people.
So that goes back to structure and process improvement. Would it be helpful for a leader or manager to ask their staff what is stressing them out?
Yes. Yes. I think so much of microstress comes because people don't communicate clearly, or are afraid to, or in a culture where we're all expected to just say yes. And we do. High performers say yes. They get it done. That's why they become the go-to people. I think it would be great to have candid conversations. What is stressing them out? And literally look at the list of to-dos and priorities. I think people forget sometimes how often we just add. And go over it with them and see, are there points of friction that you can eliminate? Is there something you as a leader can do to make clearer to both them and people they need to work with or collaborate with what the definitive ask is, rather than letting them both interpret? And also coaching the people who report to you for being more independent and for being able to do the work on their own and not needing you to micromanage at every step. That's a win for everybody if you can coach to the point where they can begin to advocate for themselves and say, this is too much, or you were unclear about this, or I need to realign my work because I've got too many things going on. Allowing them to have that strength to be able to advocate for themselves is a really important thing.
So helping, almost partnering with your staff a little bit.
Everybody wins if you do, because eventually you will have less responsibility for the stuff you're worrying about now, the stuff that you do want them to be better, but you have to coach them to get there. But then they have the opportunity to grow, they have the ability to self-advocate, and they get better at what they do too. So yes, partnering is a great way to think about it, because everybody wins when that is successful.
In the judiciary, I know we talk a lot about purpose, the why. Why are we doing what we do individually, as leaders, as agencies? And I'm curious if purpose plays a role in mitigating microstress or lessening the amount of microstress for individuals, for teams, for organizations.
Absolutely, it does. And in not the way you would expect. There is lots of research that tells us that having a sense of purpose is physiologically good for us. It does so many things. Our brains become more resilient when you have a sense of purpose. We are literally happier people with a sense of purpose. So purpose is hugely important in our life. But here's the mistake that most people make, and I can think of few worthier groups than the judiciary, honestly, because purpose is so important. Everybody's playing an important role. But the mistake a lot of people make is thinking of purpose as having to be big, lofty things that you achieve or don't achieve. You know, sometimes I'll speak to people and I'll say, you don't have to cure cancer to find purpose. The people who were best at dealing with microstress in our research, our 10 percenters, we're able to find purpose in everyday life. Yes, it's wonderful to be part of a system that is providing justice in the world and doing the hard work of making decisions that will set society on the right course for years to come. But it also can be having a single interaction with someone in your courtroom that day where someone's seen the fairness of the system or understood their right to present their argument or had an interaction that could have been confrontational that ended up being constructive. The 10 percenters looked for purpose in everyday moments, even something as small as, you know, mentoring someone or having a good exchange with someone. They allowed themselves to recognize that I had some purpose in that moment today. And they almost took stock every day in a way that the rest of us don't, right? We hold this bar that purpose has to be big and worthy and life goals. Those are great, but you can find purpose that's very renewing and very helpful to mitigating the microstress if you look for it in everyday interactions as well.
I'm also curious about email because that's an interaction with others and might be contributing to miscommunication, misalignment, et cetera.
So yes, it is absolutely. What we found in our research is not that the technology itself is the cause of microstress, but the culture around the use of that technology. We've conditioned ourselves to act like we are constantly on and engaged and we express it through email. One of a really interesting experiment that someone in our research did with their team was they got everybody together in the room for a 45-minute meeting. And they wrote up on a whiteboard all the ways that they communicate and collaborate collectively. So emails, virtual meetings, et cetera. And then they put next to each of those forms, they put a column of practices we want to continue and then practices we want to stop. And so for email, for example, they decided that we want to communicate in bullet points only, no long text, because that's too hard for people to quickly go through and see. We will not expect a reply to all unless you have something substantive to contribute. If you sense some kind of a disagreement brewing in the email, go immediately to in-person or phone or video so that you don't let it get buried in weird timed passive aggressive things. We don't expect you to respond to email after X time of night. If you want to put it on timed release to go out the next day, we don't want to create that culture of expectation of 24/7. And they estimated by agreeing as a team, so no one felt like they were the slacker, it saved them 18 to 24% of their work time in a week because they weren't kind of chasing the sense of we're all on all the time, being engaged in all the things. And think of the potential of things going wrong through email. We have a great example in our book from our research of a woman who gets an email from her relatively new manager at the end of the day looking for something for a presentation he has to make to the board. And then she's about to go home, but it's like, shoot, is that due tomorrow? And then she sends out an email to all the rest of her team. Are we supposed to get data to so-and-so by such and such? And then it's an hour and a half later before it's kind of cleared up. And it turns out he didn't actually need it right away. He was just asking to get going. time, but she's now not only gone home late, but she's triggered all her colleagues who'd be chasing up stuff, looking for data. And that was just from one errant email. And so we are inefficient and we create a culture of always and on and a lot. And if you streamline those as a team, agree as a team, what are our new norms of how we do this, that has a huge potential to take micro stress out of your day.
Earlier, you said we want to do two things. Remind us again.
So push back on two systemic sources of micro stress for you. Mine, for example, would be the end of meetings and the to-do list. And so I literally try to work 5 or 10 minutes into the end of every meeting I'm part of to recap and make sure we're all clear on the next steps and the takeaways. So that's push back on two things. Again, it's the interaction. It doesn't have to be that the work doesn't have to change, but the way we talk about it is in a matter of fact way in the meeting rather than a chase and follow up and stressful, whatever. So find two systemic things and try to find ways to push back or change that interaction. Find two that you're probably causing other people unintentionally and try to stop or shift that interaction in some way. Every parent knows when you've henpecked your kids, right? That does not work well for either of you. So find a different way to communicate with your kids or to check in with them, something like that. That's not going to cause a micro stress for them. And then it's going to come back in a positive way for you. And then choose a couple that you're just going to say, I'm living with it. I'm not going to start. I'm not going to keep worrying about it because it's not going to change. It's something I'm going to choose to rise above.
And to add to that, it sounds like you're also saying cultivate this resilience network as well.
I think that's probably one of the single most important takeaways for me personally from our research is the importance of a resilience network. And it just the idea that it doesn't have to be you're more social and you have better friends than everybody else. It's that different people that you have a connection with can play an important role in helping you feel resilient through difficult things. So for most people, our resilience network I think the average is 1.5 people because women have two, a spouse and a best friend, and men have one, a spouse. And that's not even healthy in our relationships when all of our need for resilience comes from that one person, right? Think about the time you've had a really bad day at work and you come home and you spend 20 minutes or half an hour dumping on some particular set of detail about something that went wrong that probably even with the most empathetic listener is boring to listen to or hard to get engaged with. The rest of your evening's not about anything but that spiral, but also you can unintentionally spiral each other. You know, whether your spouse is really empathetic, they can be like, you're right. They do not appreciate you. You need more X or Y. You go back in the next day kind of wired up as opposed to maybe having someone else who says, listen, get over it. That's life. And the kind of job that you have, there's a path forward. You can talk to your boss about X or Y, or you can talk to your colleague about X or Y. You need different types of people to feel resilient through most of what life is going to throw us.
Karen, what else would you recommend to judiciary leaders to help us acknowledge, recognize, alleviate these micro stresses for ourselves, for those we lead?
I think just understanding that it's a real thing and it's a significant thing. And again, most of us can experience the phenomenon of coming home at the end of the day and being fried without it having been a particularly crazy or difficult day. So recognizing that that's affecting everybody. It's affecting your quality of life. It's affecting your quality of work. So recognizing that microstress takes a real toll is an important step to recognizing that if I can reduce some of it, if I can acknowledge it and eliminate some, it's going to make us more effective as a team, as a group. It's going to make me a more effective leader, and it's going to improve my mental and overall well-being. I think recognizing that this is not nothing, and it's really taking a toll on us, but you can find ways to make it better. Back to that research data that eliminating a negative, one negative, can have up to the 5 times the impact of dealing with and adding more positives. So try to eliminate a couple things that could make a really big difference in your everyday life and for the life of your team, people that you work with.
Karen, where can we learn more about your work, Rob's work, this work on microstress in particular?
You can find more about my work on karendillon.net. You can find more about Rob and the cumulative body of work that he's done, and particularly this work on robcross.org. And I love to connect with people on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn, and I make great connections there and love to share ideas and learn about how people are coping with microstress and other forms of good things through that as well. So I'm happy to be in contact with anyone that's interested in learning more.
Excellent. Well, Karen, I know that I have some work to do to the 222 and building my resilience network. Those are my takeaways to your point about recapping a conversation. So I want to thank you for that. And thank you for your time today. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, Lori. I've been really happy to talk to you today.
Thanks, Lori. And thanks to our listeners. To hear more episodes of this podcast, visit the Executive Education page on fjc.dcn and click or tap Podcast. You can also search for and subscribe to this podcast on your mobile device via Apple, Google, Spotify, or YouTube. In Session, Leading the Judiciary is produced by Shelley Easter. Our program is supported by Angela Long, Jamie Mitchell, and the entire studio and live production team. Thanks for listening. Until next time. This podcast was produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.